weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to Beto da Silva for driving us through the afternoon. It is Wednesday, October 2nd. I'm Shane Dawson and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7pm, Alan Colley and Miguel Delaney reflect on last night's Champions League drama and look forward to more of the same tonight. Eric Holland is with us ahead of the launch of his new book, Unbeatable, Dublin's incredible 6 in a row. We'll also hear from Stephen Bradley ahead of Shamrock Rovers Conference League outing in Tala tomorrow and round up the rest of today's sports news headlines. If you want to have your say on any of the above or anything else besides, you can send us a text on 51552, WhatsApp 0871879200, or we're on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Good evening. Welcome along to the show. Eric Hahn and Alan Colley are already with us. Eric Hahn of RTE Sport Online. How are you, sir?
I am fantastic, Shane. How are you getting on?
Very well, very well. Alan Colley, live from our Sligo studio. How are you?
I'm good, Shane. I'm good. Home is where the heart is, Shane. But I'm still very close to you, don't worry.
You're always close at heart, Alan. You know,
thanks,
always
Shane.
Close at heart. So yeah.
How are you?
Very well, very well. Interesting to have the two of ye on together, because the last time the two of ye were in close proximity, and we will get to our news headlines and the thick of today's sporting news action, but I have to mention, Eric, you were chasing Alan Colley around the football pitch in an over 35s match and you couldn't catch him.
Absolutely. I very much felt over 35 that day as well. Alan won't remember me because I didn't get within about 20 yards of him on the day. On a nice sunny day out in Port Marnock, the result went Alan's team's way, if I remember rightly.
Shane, they were the glory days I always talk to you about. Even me over 35's days feel like a long time ago.
Well, listen, we will get into other matters very shortly. We'll actually chat about Pats and Shells in a moment as well on Monday, which was an absolute humdinger in Talca Park. However, news today, League of Ireland centred as well. Shamrock Rovers manager Stephen Bradley has been handed a one-match suspension for disparaging comments in the aftermath of their 1-1 draw with Derry City last month. The Hoops boss will now be in the stands for the crunch clash with Shelburne on Sunday as they look to claw back a 5-point deficit. Bradley described referee Damien McGrath as the worst in the league after a controversial penalty decision cost his team 3 valuable points at the Ryan McBride Brandywell. Sticking with domestic matters, Finn Harps will play 3 games in the last 8 days of the season, as the SSC Electricity Men's First Division match between the Donegal side and Wexford has been refixed for Monday, October 14th. The game at Finn Park was originally due to kick off this Friday, but Wexford's involvement in the FAI Cup semi-final means the fixture had to be moved. Wexford currently occupy 4th place in the second tier, while Finn Harps are 6th, 4 points outside the top 5. That would secure a place in the promotion playoffs. And some Sligo news, actually. Tommy Hewitt has departed as Sligo Rovers boss with just 2 games to go in the SSC Electricity Women's Premier Division season. Hewitt took charge at the showgrounds at the start of the season. Sligo currently sit bottom of the table with 5 points from 18 matches. Before we get the latest in the cricket and indeed the Emerging Ireland rugby match as well, let's just rip the plaster. Eric, I know you're a Pats fan. Alan, I know you're there as a neutral in Talca Park on Monday. Alan, have you recovered from such a spectacle?
Just about, Shane. I was only thinking about it again today. It was just amazing. What a game. And now that we're down to the business end, I hope there's maybe 3 or 4 of these games to come, because even though I mentioned on air it's probably not been the most vintage League of Ireland season in terms of quality, the fact that it's so competitive and so dramatic, I think it makes for such a spectacular viewing really at this stage. And now we're counting down to the big game on Sunday. You have the cup semi-finals this coming weekend. You have 3-4 teams still who have some sort of belief that they can still win the league. So we're in for an unbelievable month, but it really was a brilliant game, Shane.
Yeah, you might even argue you've 6 teams still in the running, an outside chance. Sligo Rovers might even push for a league title, Alan Colley. Perhaps that's wishful thinking. Are St. Pat's in the title race, Eric?
I think St. Pat's are just about in the title race, Shane. Now, when it comes to fair weather fans, I have to put my cards on the table here. I'm about as fair weather as it gets, but I've been paying a little bit more attention in the last 6 or 8 weeks.
Now that you're on a good run of form.
Now that we're on a good run of form, absolutely. I'm very much on the bandwagon. I just think Pat's are plus playing outstanding football at the time. In fact, Alan, myself and Shane were just talking beforehand. I don't think I've ever seen an in-season turnaround in a player the way we've seen in Jake Mulroney, for example. Now, lots of Pats players are playing very well, but Jake Mulroney, from where he was 12, 14 weeks ago, he looks like the best player in the league at the moment. That's a bit biased maybe, but what do you think, Alan?
Yeah, it's a fair point, Eric, and I think that speaks volumes for the management of Stephen Kenny, because of course we all seen what Stephen done with Dundalk, amazing achievements in his time there. Then he gets the Ireland job, and of course didn't pan out the way that he wanted, but you look at the job he's done in revitalising St Patrick's Athletic, the club, and also the individuals that are playing there as well. So I would agree fully with that, Eric. Stephen has some sort of magic. It's hard to finger. It's almost like when you hear people talk about the magic sponge, when people run on and all of a sudden the player gets a rub of a sponge and water and he's up running around. Stephen has some sort of magic as a manager. And what struck me about the game on Monday night as well, you're going away to a team, obviously Shelburne, I know they haven't been in a great run of form, but they were still top of the league and going for a league title. Yet Stephen's approach, it's unrecognisable St Pat's from the team at the start of the season. When you think of the attacking players that he had, he had the back four, Jamie Lennon obviously protecting them. After that, they are so attack minded, it's unbelievable. When you think of Elbazetti on the right, Mulroney on the left, Forrester in alongside Lennon, Brandon Kavanagh, and then Keane up top, it's brilliant to watch. And one thing about Eric, whether to win the league or not this year, I think they're probably just going to run out of games, but the St Patrick's fans must be so excited for next season, because I'd have them nearly down as favourites to win the league if they maintain the form between now and the end of the season.
Yeah, incredible stuff. Stephen, the magician, Kenny. Lots to discuss, and we will hear from Stephen Bradley a little bit later on ahead of Shamrock Rovers Conference League match, and we'll get more dug into the title race later on this evening. We have Champions League review and preview to come as well. And indeed, Eric, we're going to be chatting about your book that's coming out, Unbeatable, Dublin's incredible 6 in a row. So lots to look forward to. We still have news headlines actually to wrap up. Some texts actually coming in. 51552. The Shells Pats game on Monday was incredible. Des Curran's commentary and knowledge of Irish football is brilliant. Hear. I wholeheartedly agree with the anonymous text who doesn't have a name to that one. Stephen Bradley gets a game ban for criticising referee. John Russell gets a 3-game ban for something similar, says Paul in Sligo. And the Bows game this Friday and the Shells game on Sunday should be 2 belters, says another texter. Indeed, and hopefully the other semi-final as well, Drogheda and Wexford on Sunday afternoon. Elsewhere, before we return to football, the Ireland men's cricket team are taking on South Africa in the first of 3 one-day internationals in the UAE this afternoon. South Africa won the toss, they decided to bat first, and they posted 271 for 9 of their 50 overs. In reply, Ireland are 65 for 5 from 15.5 overs. And the last ball of overs has just been bowled. So 65 for 5 off 16 overs. Ireland require another 207 runs with 5 wickets remaining. 204 balls to get those runs. So Ireland up against it somewhat. Hopefully goes well for the Irish side, and we'll keep you up to date on that one. The emerging Ireland rugby side kicked off their tour of South Africa with a 36-24 victory over the Pumas. Zach Ward impressed on the wing, scoring the first of Ireland's 6 tries and carrying strongly throughout the 80 minutes in the heat of Bloemfontein. Darren Murray and Cormac Izichukwu added further first half tries, while Stephen Smith, Gus McCarthy and a penalty try completed the Irish try scoring. Ireland next face Western Force on Sunday at midday Irish time. We can get reaction to that victory with player Alex Kendellan and first the emerging Ireland head coach Simon Easterby.
I think to a man, our guys stepped up to the challenge, and I think these tours are always going to be challenging. They're always going to put us under pressure for time, but you know, certainly wouldn't look for any excuses in terms of our preparation. But I thought, on the whole, we were outstanding, and everyone showed up really well.
Yeah, like you said, it's a massive opportunity. It was said when we first came in that there's an opportunity there to play for Ireland, and there's a clear path. We saw with the last tour how many lads went on and played for Ireland. So, the clear path is there, and I think we're all just trying our best to get there.
Just another one, a few words on Zach Ward. Simon, looked like he was playing for a contract.
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure about his contractual situation at the moment, but no, he was excellent. I think Goody said it earlier we had a meeting earlier with the backs, and just looking forward to seeing Zach break tackles and beat people one-on-one. And you can see out there he did that countless times. I think shifting from sevens to 15s is a really, we want to see those guys do that. But in terms of conditioning and fitness, it's a different game.
And I thought he stood up really well. He started to sort of cramp up a little bit towards the back end of the game, but stayed in the game. And, you know, he showed up really well, and should be really pleased with the way he went about his business, you know, along with the other guys. And Zach will also feel that there's still things that he's continuing to learn about the 15s game in that position, which, again, he's not that familiar with.
Game on.
Football.
Now, from rugby football to association football, Alan Colley is still with us as we begin our Champions League review and indeed preview. And joining us as well is Miguel Delaney, chief football writer with The Independent. Miguel, how are you, sir?
Not too bad.
Good.
Adapting to the Champions League week.
Yeah. Enjoying the new format and all the matches coming thick and fast, Miguel?
No, I think it's terrible.
Thank you.
That was blunt. I've been to three games so far, and all the three games would sound like the sort of European events. Like, you know, look, when I was a young journalist, the sort of thing I would have wanted to go to: Liverpool away at Milan, I was at Arsenal away at Atlanta, and I was at Arsenal at home to Paris Saint-Germain last night. And the overriding feeling is that it's this sort of kind of confected fake sport, in the sense that there's no jeopardy, or there's very little jeopardy, I should say. The big clubs are pretty much guaranteed to go through to the top 24. And I know people will say, oh, well, like, it's staggered. They have to try and get into the top eight. And, you know, there are costs to finishing from 9th to 24th. But, and yes, they'll want to avoid that. But that's still not the same as the threat of elimination. And it's like they're kind of... And also, let's not forget, this is in a world, and one of the reasons we have this system is because the big clubs wanted more games anyway. They actually wanted this opening league stage to be 10 or 12. And I think there's all sorts of issues with it. And I wrote this for a few years before it actually happened. It just sidesteps the real problem in football these days, particularly that level of European football, which is massive financial disparity, which didn't exist in anything like it did today 30 years ago or even 20 years ago, and has massively accelerated in the last 10 years. There's a massive discussion you can have about that. But for the moment, it's left this kind of Champions League group stage. I mean, the amount of people, even in football, that were getting onto me last night, some of them who were at the Arsenal Paris Saint-Germain game, saying, this feels like one of these pre-season games in America, which is sort of the intention.
Is it a concern for yourself as well? Even looking at some of the results last night, we have, 3-4-0s, a 7-1, a 5-0. Now, granted, PSV and Sporting was a decent match. Arsenal fans were happy, and Leverkusen defeated Milan, and Stuttgart and Sparta Prague also finished 1-1. But is it a concern, this disparity, Alan?
Yeah, I've been following Miguel's tweets. I know he's not happy with it, to be honest, and the articles that he's written about as well. And when you look at the scores, as you say, Shane, last night, a 7, a 5, 2-4s. But I just think it's a sign of the times, like coming off the Euros as well. It was the same thing. Once you have the expansion in the tournament, there's very little jeopardy in the group stage. All about commercial revenue, the more games, more money coming in. And I just think, I'm not sure how you fix it, because I always felt, and I said this to you many times, Shane, was just the fact that the early part of the old format of the Champions League did feel a bit kind of stale as well. And I always felt the tournament only got going once you hit the business end and the knockout stage. But unfortunately, when you're trying to give opportunities to all the other clubs to maybe go through a group stage or a group phase or be in a league format like this, you have to start somewhere to try and get to that knockout stage. And I would love if we were just down to a 16 or a 24 and you see the knockout games and straight into that with the best teams. But unfortunately, that's not going to happen. And whilst I would agree with a lot of what Miguel says just about the game, and even watching that one last night with Arsenal and PSG, I'm not sure how you fix it, because this is the new format that they have come up with. And when you look at the situation that we have with the league format, is it better than the early part of the group stage that we would have had last year? I don't think so.
But just on that point, because I think this is crucial. Yes, I'm not sure it's actually better. I think it's much the same as the last few years of the group stage. But I think there's a really important point to make on that, because I was thinking about it last night, as obviously Arsenal played the French champions, who are themselves owned by Qatar, a whole other issue. But if you look, say, at 98, Arsenal in group stage with Lens, they didn't get through. 2001, they're in group stage with Lyon, both French sides at the time. They squeezed through on results against Lyon. They're both on 8 points. And what is the and this is in an era, let's not forget, where those Champions League group stages, at that point, they were still really exacting. We can all remember, I'm sure, the Manchester United games in the 90s, where, you know, games against Rapid Vienna or Fenerbahce felt massive matches. So what's happened? What is the difference? The difference is, financial inequality. That's what UEFA have basically allowed to explode over 20 years. Like, I think we haven't had a winner of the Champions League that hasn't had a revenue of, I think it's less than 460 million euro since 2013. And that was Bayern Munich anyway. All this, of course, comes from the threat that's been held over all this to try and enforce the situations. The big clubs constantly get more and more money. It was the Super League. And just as an example of like how this actually works. So for the last decade, since 2016, since the first push to get that, actually the 2021 Super League, the first time that was raised, rather in order to kind of to not proceed with the Super League, which of course they did anyway, the big club has managed to get this leverage out of UEFA where it was essentially like Champions League royalties. So what that meant in 2021, Leicester and Chelsea were going for the last Champions League final, last Champions League place in England on the final day of the season, if you remember. Had Leicester qualified, they would have been guaranteed at least 1.5 million from the competition qualifying. Had Chelsea qualified, because they'd played in the competition so much over the last decade, they would have been guaranteed at least 30 million. And so that alone, you're immediately widening the gap. That little example, that's been spread out all over Europe for the past 20 years. That's why we're in a situation where so many of these games are a joke. And like even Celtic, getting hammered by Dortmund last night. But the 2001, remember, they were in that group with Juventus, Rosenberg, some proper games there, and like a properly competitive Celtic. So the way you address it isn't messing around with the format, because that's just evading the problem. It's football has to have a proper discussion with itself about its direction, its economic direction, who come in. And like, I mean, if you look at the whole Champions League era as well, it's coincided with unprecedented long runs of, say, one team winning a single league, Bayern Munich being the biggest example, Juventus another, but across so many medium and smaller leagues as well. And that's because of Champions League prize money and the effect of that. So, like, I mean, just messing with the format doesn't really, it prolongs the problem.
Yeah, but Miguel, football's never going to have that conversation. We know we're way past that now.
I would actually disagree with that. A, because what's actually going to happen is, and ultimately, because it's this open market, football will be dictated by that. That's, of course, why we're talking about Super Leagues at the moment, because the Champions League was beginning to fail. So they had to look at something else, because viewers were dropping. Now, evidently, they couldn't get the Super League through. But there are other issues here, and this is where it gets very interesting. If you go back to the European Court of Justice case on the Super League in December 2023, there is a specific clause in that UEFA now can't just say that it has to start being mindful of solidarity. They have to show. It's interesting, because on Friday there's going to be this case on Lassana Diarra, the former Chelsea player, which could have repercussions for the transfer window. And it's the first time someone has really tested this in the new era. But the same sort of thing, because the precedent is here now, or the legal framework is here, because this ECJ case, if someone starts to test it, that's when this sort of thing starts to get very interesting. Because the EU as well is taking a very active interest right now on just what is becoming of the football industry, especially given its immense cultural importance in Europe. And also on that point as well, I'd be very curious as to the viewing figures for some of these games now.
Mm. Yeah, there's so much on and across a host of television stations, both in Britain and indeed in Ireland. Alan, would you be hopeful then? Maybe I'm a bit too downbeat, I'm a bit too negative, that we can turn a corner with football on the European side of things?
I'd love to think we could, Shane, but we're so far down the road now, and it's not just in soccer, it's with all the other sports as well. You can talk about the PGA Tour and golf with viewing figures as well, and ever since the players were, the carrot was dangling in front of them with LIV Golf as well. You can look at snooker going over to Saudi Arabia, the boxing as well has been taken over by that, hosting their own events, Saudi Arabian events in London last week, and dictating it all on their terms. So I just worry for sport in that regard. We all love sport for what we were brought up on, and the soul of the sport, but the soul of the sport has been sold out on so many different levels in different sports that it's hard to point the finger at one, because we'd be hypocritical if we're just pointing it at football when it's in so many others. But I'd love to think we could go back to the old school way, but we're so far down the road in this, Shane. Now FIFA, now we're going against UEFA with the threat of the Club World Cup next year to try and compete with this, and as Miguel said there, to try and stave off the threat of the Super League and the big clubs going away on that. So money dictates, unfortunately. Unfortunately, and I'd love to think we will have the conversation one day, but how and when is beyond me.
Mm. Gents, just from the footballing side of things, I know, Miguel, you were at Arsenal. It wasn't a great atmosphere, and it felt like a bit of a preamble at times. What would you read into that victory from Arsenal's point of view? What impressed you?
The one thing I said, I've been to Arsenal a fair bit lately and covered obviously their rise over the past few years. I think it was very significant for Arsenal actually in the sense of, because last year they were in a situation where, you know, for all the wealth and everything I'm going on about, they were adapting to Champions League football again. Whereas I think a game like that showed just how advanced they are, especially against a club that would be considered, you know, one of their rivals in terms of potentially winning it. Now, there's a bit more dynamic there because obviously Arsenal basically took the decision about 5 years ago under Arteta that they had to go a different route and build a team, like you strip it down and build up a team again, and quite a young team. And Paris Saint-Germain, after a decade of this star system, like Galactique, as they obviously took it from Real Madrid, they eventually decided in 2023 they had to abandon that and do something like what Arsenal are doing now, and actually went for Arteta that summer in 2023. So I think what we saw last night was basically just how much more advanced Arsenal are against a team like that in Paris Saint-Germain. Who's, I mean, they can still sign some of the best young players. Also, Paris is actually one of the three areas in the world that's the most fertile production ground for footballers, along with Sao Paulo and South London. So that's what they really want to capitalise on, like Mbappe being the main example who's just left them. Mm. But yeah, Arsenal obviously more advanced. And I think the one thing I would take from the game as a whole and just watching a lot of these teams, I think there's a fair argument that actually Arsenal are what? Possibly the third best team in Europe right now after Manchester City and Real Madrid. I think they have made a bit of a step up since last season. And given that this competition isn't always won by the best team in Europe, they should be thinking about really, there's an opportunity here.
Yeah, Alan, what attributes do Arsenal have that would make you believe they can genuinely contend for both a Premier League and a Champions League title?
Well, they've so many attributes, but the biggest one is the fact that they have two styles of play. We watched them against Leicester and the lesser teams, if you like, in the Premier League, and in possession they're absolutely outstanding and can dismantle teams at will, and like what we've seen last year, blowing teams away in the early stages of games. But then if you look at the last 2 or 3 weeks, and they've been compared almost to a Mourinho-style football and being defensive against Spurs initially, and then when they went down to 10 men against Man City. And they're just so resilient and so well set up defensively as well, Shane, that's why I'm a big fan. I think they have two styles of play. And sometimes I think when a certain team are very one-dimensional, I almost think it takes away from them then, whoever that team may be, whereas I always love to see a team adapt into the situation that they're in, and Arsenal are the best at that in the league, because they can play both ways, and that's why I've been shouting and roaring about them for the last kind of 2 years. I think Arteta's done an unbelievable job, and I think this will be the year that they will go on and win the league. But to Miguel's point, and I would agree as well, because they're so good defensively, and whether it's a knockout game away from home or at home, and they know they can just set up and sit in a low block and hit teams on the counter attack, if you like, they will fancy their chances against anyone in that situation as well. So absolutely they're one of the favourites for both competitions, if you like, and I think they've a great chance in both.
I do want to pick both your brains on this evening's matches. Before we do, just on last night, Miguel, you mentioned the financial disparity. Obviously, perhaps it was a bit of a reality check for Celtic in a 7-1 drubbing against Dortmund. What else caught your eye then from a footballing point of view, Miguel?
In terms of the competition,
yeah,
from last night.
From last night, yeah.
Well, I mean, I suppose the striking thing about Celtic in that sense, I mean, you can't escape the fact that on the day before the game, Rodgers was going on about reaching another level. Mm. And then you see that. I mean, it shouldn't be laughing, really, because obviously this is actually an indication of a lot of the problems that I'm talking about. And it's a shame you have this. Although I suppose maybe people might say it's also maybe a consequence of how Rodgers approaches some of these games. But then again, we come back to the same issue where, I suppose, Celtic, as bad as that was and as damaging as it was for the club's pride, Celtic can kind of just write it off, because the games that are really going to be decide whether they get through come against Young Boys and Club Brugge. They're Celtic's two crunch matches, which is kind of, I think, will speak think to how lopsided the system is. I think I think this is actually interesting, kind of points to some of what we're talking about. You asked me what's caught my eye. Like, it does feel with the competition at the moment, it's so new in terms of the format. It's so kind of open-ended. Also, because clubs, ironically, because almost every club can play almost every club, although obviously that's limited to eight fixtures, that actually means each club is only ever seeing everything on their own terms. It's almost like they're in a little bubble. Because, say, with last night's games, in previous circumstances, Arsenal PSG would be significant to finish top of the group. So there'd be a direct effect on each other. Similarly, Celtic with Dortmund. Whereas with this, they can almost just look to the table then. Like, it doesn't have that much of a bearing bar on kind of the number of points you can accumulate at the end. So I think from that perspective, it's quite strange, and we don't really have a kind of a sense of it yet. The one thing I would say, actually, I think the last match day is going to be very exciting, just because there will be kind of that, there'll be that toss up for those key players, especially around, say, position 7 to 9, and who gets into the automatic last 16, and positions then 23 to 25 about who gets into the playoff. The point would be the amount of football to get there to that one night. It's 100 plus games where they all feel a bit like last night's match between Arsenal and Paris Saint-Germain. And as someone said to me today, all for what? So by the end, it's Real Madrid and Manchester City in the final again. Well, let's see with the City situation.
That's true. There could be in the Johnson Paint Trophy final
The flip side of that, Shane, though, you look at Brest, the French team, and they're after getting off the two wins in their first two matches and beating Salzburg 4-0 last night. So they'll be absolutely loving the new format and the new situation, because when you look at them domestically, they're sitting 13th after six games of the French league already. So struggling, but in terms of the Champions League, they're absolutely flying in those two games, which, again, like Miguel said, very winnable games, because they're only playing Salzburg and Sturm Graz, and they're opening two and already sit with 6 points on the board.
Well, I love the same lines, actually. Villa Bayern, to be fair, is a proper event tonight, just in the sense, like, Villa, a club with like a proud, like, this is obviously a replay of their 1982 European Cup final that Villa won. And like, there's just the sense of event about it. But I just like my feeling from attending it is that sense of event is just not as frequent as it should be for the number of games there are. And I would say what the Champions League should be as well. I mean, like, even you were talking about that's another thing that struck me as well. I actually counted this morning, the number of thrashings. So in 27 games so far, there's been 8 wins by 4 goals or more. Obviously, the biggest was Bayern against Zagreb. Last season, in the entire group stage, there was 4 wins. But now that last season was actually usually low. But even then, the frequency of big wins is out of kilter with the last few years. So that's something that has been notable about the competition so far as well.
Very much so. At least there is a bit of nostalgia and good feeling, particularly for Aston Villa fans, I'd imagine, Alan. European football returning to Villa Park, as Miguel says, a repeat of the 1982 final. Can this match salvage what the negativity that is going around, Alan?
Yeah, I think this was, like, as I say, if we were to have this conversation at this time last year, it probably would have been negative enough as well around the earlier format. Yeah. I think come after Christmas, Miguel, don't worry, we'll have you on and we'll have lots of positivity with the knockout games, I hope. But certainly tonight, Shane, Aston Villa, look, Emery is getting all the plaudits since he's come in. He's done a phenomenal job. And I do think this will be a great game. Bayern Munich, surprised that company took over, but he's actually had a great start since he's gone in. They only drew at the weekend against Bayer Leverkusen, but up to that, they had won all their games, so he's had a brilliant start, scoring loads of goals, as we've outlined, 9 already in their opening night in the Champions League. But I do think this will be a serious game and a serious event, and Villa, who've been absolutely brilliant, they'll be disappointed that they only drew against Ipswich on Sunday, especially when they took the lead 2-1 up. I thought they'd go on and get the 3 points, so he was disappointed after the match, Emery, but I do think they'll give Bayern Munich a game and it'll be a cracker tonight.
Can Unai Emery conjure up a tactical masterclass, and can the Villa players perform, Miguel, and get a win?
I think so. I mean, I think I wouldn't say this definitively yet, but I think Unai Emery is probably a better manager than Vincent Kompany. Obviously, Vincent Kompany is much earlier in his career, and Emery has a much better record. But a part of that record has been about his European campaigns, and mostly in the second tier competition in the Europa League. But I think that met with the kind of the atmosphere around Villa Park tonight. What Villa are as a team now, they have got a high wage bill. They've actually spent a fair bit. And also, Bayern they've still looked a little bit vulnerable. They drew at the weekend against Leverkusen, who kind of did a little bit of a number on them. And they still haven't been what you'd expect from Bayern. But I'm tempted to go for kind of a Villa win in the same way, say, that Newcastle beat Paris Saint-Germain last season. Just that kind of that sort of atmosphere that can come over a big English club in that first game back in the Champions League like that.
Kylian Mbappe on the bench for Real Madrid away to Lille, and Atletico Madrid away to Benfica. Alan, are you looking forward to seeing these Madrid clubs playing? Because I know you enjoyed the Madrid derby the other night.
It was chaotic, Shane, yeah, but it was great viewing. It really was, and they obviously snuck the equaliser late on at Atletico Madrid after the stoppage when the fans were going bananas and Simeone had to go down and have a chat with them. But I've been disappointed with Real Madrid so far, obviously coming off the back of winning the Champions League, and you sign Mbappe. We did the Super Cup and they ran out easy winners against Atalanta, but they've drawn three games in the league already, Shane, and they just haven't hit the heights. And I know it might take a little bit of time, but when you think of the players and the quality they have on the pitch, I was expecting so much more from them, even at this early stage. Now Mbappe didn't play at the weekend, but still in all, the quality that they had on the pitch. Now Atletico, to be fair, have spent a lot of money as well, and they had Conor Gallagher playing, and they had the lad they got from City as well up front, the Argentinian lad, his name escapes me.
Julian Alvarez.
Yeah, Alvarez, yeah. And I was expecting a bit more from them also, but I've just been a little bit disappointed so far. But even at this early stage, I suppose all the talk in Spanish football has been about the start Barcelona have had with Hansi Flick. They've had a great start, and again, scoring plenty last night. They got five against Young Boys. Lewandowski still banging them in. Because I watched Barcelona live last year, Shane, and if someone had to say to me they'd start the season next year and be top of the league after six, seven games and banging in goals, I would have laughed really, because they were a million miles off it when I saw them. But he seems to have done a good job since he's come in, Hansi Flick.
Yeah, speaking of Barcelona, just briefly, former Arsenal goalkeeper Wojciech Szczęsny has joined Barcelona until the end of the season, just over a month since he retired from football. Elsewhere, Leipzig host Juventus, Club Brugge are away to Sturm Graz, Dinamo Zagreb, Monaco, and Liverpool at home to Bologna. Miguel, final word to yourself in this part of the show. What's going to be the deciding factor at Anfield between those two sides?
I don't want to sound boring, but I think ultimately it's basic quality. Bologna, it's a little bit, I suppose, of a breath situation there, in the sense that they're a club that have done well to qualify. That's their achievement. And like they have overachieved in that sense. And really, like, I mean, Liverpool, they are just a higher level. If all goes normally, they should win. Although I think it is worth saying that this could have been quite difficult for Slot. I mean, obviously people will go on about how good the Liverpool squad is, as I've just done there. But still, as we've seen countless times in the past now, on some of Liverpool's rivals, and also Liverpool themselves going back to 1991, it's not necessarily easy to take over from giant club figures in the way Arne Slot has. But he's handled it. Like, it's almost like his demeanour has helped. And that's also been reflected in the football, which is extremely controlled. Like, it is much closer to, say, the Pep Guardiola school than Klopp's idea. But it has kind of, other than that one result against Forest, which is going to happen, they've just looked so competent. They have these occasional bursts of quality. They're not necessarily as exhilarating as Klopp's Liverpool, but they just kind of they scream kind of about getting the job done in quite a high quality way.
Indeed. We're going to have to leave the conversation there for now. Miguel Delaney, thank you so much for joining us. Gentlemen, Alan, you're going to stick around. We're going to chat League of Ireland a little bit later on. Just to update you, two matches ongoing in the Champions League. At halftime, Feyenoord lead away to Girona 2-1, and Shakhtar Donetsk are trailing at home 2-0 to Atalanta. Two Conference League matches took place this evening today. With a bit of an Irish twist as well. Istanbul Başakşehir, who conquered Pats this summer, they lost at home to Rapid Vienna 2-1. And Victoria de Guimarães 3-1 victors over Celje, who of course played Shamrock Rovers. We're taking a short break, and then Eric Holland is still with us as we chat about his upcoming book, Dublin, The Unbeatable Six in a Row Journey. Stick with us here on Game On 2FM.
Game On.
Gaelic football.
In August 2014, Jim Gavin's Dublin seemed unstoppable. They were playing football at a level not seen in years, overwhelming opposition and seemingly growing stronger with every game. Nobody saw it coming. Donegal's beautifully timed semi-final ambush. The Ulstermen laid bare a chink in the Sky Blues' armour, a tactical hole which Gavin immediately set about filling. Dublin would not lose a championship game again for 2,540 days. Dublin spent 7 years in footballing nirvana, an era of dominance and drama in which Gaelic football changed forever.
The build-up is completely focused on Mayo, and certainly Mayo are a different animal this year. But I think Dublin have been coming in under the radar.
Favourites don't give underdogs a second chance. Fitzfield's loose outside here. He's put it.
into stoppage time. 40 metres out. Rock kicking up into the air. It's all over. And Dublin are again the champions. The three in a row. The first time a team from Dublin has won it.
We're crying, crying. So let the velvet roll down.
Such a tight group. We've been playing together for 8, 9 years, 10 years now, and we do everything together. We train hard together. We go socialise together. We're best friends. We've got a wedding to remember. So just the all the work comes together for this. It's just special. You know?
Our debut was a masterpiece. Our lines we read so perfectly.
Merchant bursting forward immediately. Morland trying to catch up with him. Merchant still going. Sherlock embrace. Dublin are the history makers.
Amber lights along the way and a late diversion as well. But Dublin's drive for five is over. Destination reached.
It's time to renew the rivalry. Comes to O'Callaghan again. Fiston inside here. Dangerous. Scully's involved. And there's another one. And it's come O'Callaghan. And Dublin are still the champions. It's six in a row.
Well, some good listening for Dublin GA fans, I would imagine. The reason we were listening to that montage is because Eric Hahn is with his multimedia sports journalist with RTE Online, who has put pen to paper on your first book, Eric, that comes out. Well, the book launch on Tuesday, October 8th, and the book is on shelves the previous day, Monday, October 7th. That's this coming Monday, the book launch in Dewberry Brook. On Mary Street. So if you're around Mary Street, do get in for the book launch. As I mentioned, it is unbeatable. Dublin's incredible six in a row. Eric, I'd imagine, considering you're involved with your local St Finian's Newcastle club and you are a Dubs fan, you're coaching the ladies team with St Finian's at the moment, this was a bit of a labour of love.
Certainly was that, Shane. Had a very kind of, I suppose, a very basic sort of motivation for writing the book, in that I just thought it was a book that should exist, that someone should write it. And then I suppose at some point I must have sort of talked myself into it. You know, they were a team I don't think we'll ever see the likes of again, which is probably good news for some, for 31 counties. But, you know, once I kind of delved into it, and I kind of sat down one day and I thought, if I can write a bit of an intro here and it kind of reads half decent, I might just give this a crack. I did that, the intro that's in the book now. I think I wrote it 2.5 years ago and it hasn't really changed. And once I get into it, you know, I thought these are the kind of GA books you'd like to see more of. We sometimes I think to myself, how well do we really know our great GA teams? And I don't know if this book opens that door a little bit, but I hope it does. But I just think it's something that somebody in 10 years or 20 years or 50 years should be able to pick up, read, and know a little bit more about what, for me, was as good a football team, maybe the best football team we're ever going to see.
Yeah, yeah. Cards on the table. Obviously, you can probably tell from my accent that, of course, I am a Dublin fan as such. And
Even though I'm wearing a Kilkenny top
of Kilkenny ties as well. But you'd imagine, and it does, to be fair, from reading it this afternoon, even, like, it's a genuine page-turner, and it strips back that Dublin team, because there are such characters, and that goes across the board for a lot of Gaelic football teams, that great Kilkenny team and so on, that there are characters there that perhaps were guarded, perhaps they had to be guarded. Were they cocooned too much, that Dublin group, or was it just a necessity?
I think it's sort of, it's something that people in our industry, Shane, would obviously, you know, discuss at length. You know, there's always discussions about access to players and access to teams and stuff, and that's kind of a general kind of sports person conversation, and I suppose we have to balance that with the fact that GA players are amateurs, so there's a certain kind of privacy that they're probably obviously always going to be entitled to more than a professional sports star. But, you know, that Dublin team were so, they had so many characters in them, and yet you'd kind of love to know that little bit more about them. And again, like you said, those Kilkenny teams, or even myself, I don't remember the Dublin teams and the Kerry teams of the 70s. But even as years pass, you know, you'd kind of even love to know a little bit more about those characters rather than just the games themselves, you know.
What did you learn about the Jim Gavin process and from writing the book, is there anything that has stood out to you personally, perhaps, that you mightn't have twigged or might stood out, might be a bit more prevalent now looking back and reflecting on it?
Well, Gavin's attention to detail seemed to be just like second to none. Like when I spoke to players who played against Dublin or coaches who'd coached against them, when I'd asked them what they remember about playing Dublin or what they thought made Dublin tick or made them what they were, I was fully expecting, I suppose looking at it from a fan's point of view, I was fully expecting to hear them talk about, you know, Dermot Connolly driving a kick pass in 50 yards, Bernard Brogue and Brian Fenton, Con O'Callaghan, but every single one of them independently all come back to Dublin's absolute mastery of the basics, you know, doing the ordinary things extraordinarily well, as they say. And, you know, that's what elite players playing against them notice. You know, I remember speaking to Conor Madden, who played against them for Cavan in 2020, just saying, you just knew that Dublin minded the ball so well and had such mastery of the very simple things that it made you conscious of the fact that if I give this ball away, if we give them this ball, we might not see it for 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, you know. And yet, like, obviously there was an appreciation for the particularly skilled players or the brilliant players, but they all come back and said the same things: the Dublin's absolute mastery of the simple things, the basic things. Stephen Poacher, who coached against them with Carlo, put it, the presentation of their passing was how he phrased it, which meant the passes were on the money. A player got a pass exactly where he wanted it, and that made it bloody hard for the other guys to get it back, I suppose.
Yeah. One county that pushed Dublin quite often was Mayo. And I think even perhaps it can go overlooked at times, and even from reading the book, perhaps it was a bit more prevalent as well, just how good that team were and how desperately unlucky that team were.
They were, and that was something unexpected, I have to say, that I found, having kind of gone through the book and gone through the process of researching and the stuff, I must admit to a newfound appreciation for Mayo. I also must admit to having been a little bit hard-hearted to them in the past. I always found them, I'd found them a little bit overrated, because, you know, winning is important, and they didn't get over that line. So I used to sometimes think they were talked about a bit too much. But at one point during the book, of course, I had to go back over all of the games, all of the big games, the knockout games, the Dublin Mayo games, the Dublin Kerry games, all of those All-Ireland finals. And I happened to kind of, I watched all of the Dublin Mayo games over the course of maybe 1 day or 1.5 days. And I sat at home in my home office with my head in my hand, and I just thought, how did Mayo not beat these at one point, you know? And I hope I'm not damning them with faint praise. I just thought they really were very unlucky. I have to say, in hindsight, I didn't feel that way at the time, I must admit.
Yeah.
But in hindsight, a bloody good Mayo side. And in particular, if you talk about the first day in 2016, Paul Flynn has talked about it since, that was the day Mayo should have bet Dublin. And when you watch that game back, that's it. I mean, you could come to no other conclusion. Mayo were desperately unlucky, and they were a huge part of the whole thing. They really were. Again, at the time, you're immersing as a Dublin fan, and I probably saw only that side of it. But Mayo were just such a huge part of the story. You can't tell the story of that Dublin team without talking about Mayo.
Oh, for sure. There's a big debate, and before you even actually start writing, in John O'Leary, in his foreword, who states that the 1995 team has given all they can to the Dublin setup from a management perspective. Of course, what Jim has done, what Desi is currently doing. The next guys have to come from the 2011 group. Would you agree?
Yeah, it looks that way, and it was a great point. Something I have to say, until John said it, I hadn't really thought about. I was very lucky. John gave me a fantastic foreword for the book. It's actually my favourite part of the book, which is probably a stupid thing to say considering I wrote the.
You're just being humble here. Yeah, just being humble.
Yeah. But he makes a great point. Like he says, 2011 still feels very recent. Well, you know, it's 13 years ago now. It's going to soon be 14. That 95 team gave you Gilroy, Gavin and Desi, of course, but it also gave you numerous selectors, Mick Galvin over the years, Paul Clark, Jason Sherlock, Declan Darcy, who didn't play in that 95 team but played against them, and then later joined them. And, you know, John says in his foreword, he said, the next group has to come from that 2011 team. It's time to start drawing from that well. It's their turn, basically, was kind of his point. And he's really right, and I hadn't really thought of it. And you'd love to know who are the candidates, you know, like
Ger Brennan, I suppose, is the obvious one.
He started his career quite well. You know, like a lot of, like, is Stephen Cluxton the sort of guy? He might surprise you. He might. Stephen as Cluxton could retire and we might never hear from him again, or he could go and manage Dublin. Who knows? Mm. I know the panel, for those who know the panel quite well, I always preach the kind of continuity aspect of it, and the players are so sort of self-governed and self-motivated that, you know, someone from within, like Darcy was often seen as the next man, but he's been away from the panel now since Gavin left in 2019. So a lot of those players have moved on. You've got Brian Cullen, who was a fantastic player, coaching experience. But it probably is going to be someone from that 2011 panel. Darren Daly, of course, is selector. It's very interesting. Like it was a point John made that I hadn't really thought of previously, but the next man in Dublin is going to be a very interesting kind of discussion.
One to watch. I don't know. Eamon Fennell, S&C coach. Philly McMahon, backs coach, maybe. Mm. Thinking off the top of my head here. Stephen Cluxton, just there's your goalkeeper coach. It could have an amalgamation of everything.
He'd be a pretty good goalkeeper coach, all right.
Yeah, it wouldn't be half. And a badminton coach as well, just ask Nat Wynn as well from his school days in Vincent's. Listen, Eric Hahn, we're going to have to leave the conversation there. We have to take a short break. But as I mentioned, the book is out on Monday. It's your first book, so wish you all the very best. Genuinely unbeatable, Dublin's incredible 6 in a row. A cracking read, I must say so myself. Okay, we're taking a short break. Eric, thank you so much. Alan Colley is still with us. We're going to chat League of Ireland and hear from Stephen Bradley, ahead of Shamrock Rovers Conference Day clash tomorrow.
Game on.
Football.
Now, there's European football in Tallaght Stadium tomorrow. Stephen Bradley, Shamrock Rovers manager, was speaking with our own Tony O'Donoghue earlier this afternoon.
First of all, just give me a bit of housekeeping, Stephen. Who's in and who's out? Have you got injury concerns?
It looks like Josh has came through to scare him against St. Pat's. Okay, the scan was clear, and he looks good to go, which is great. Only Rory and... Well, that's we got Rory and one more missing, but everyone else is okay.
Sean Hoare had been a doubt. Is he all right?
Yeah, Sean's okay. He's back in training this week. Aaron Mack is back in training this week as well, so both of them are okay.
Before we talk about the Applewell game, I just would like your thoughts on the Shells-Pats game, and Pats who beat you at the weekend continuing their good form. Are they in the title race at this point, do you think?
Yeah, they could be. I don't think anyone's over. When you look how close it is, the first six positions are really, really tight. So it's all to play for the last few games, and everything's to play for. So yeah, it makes for an exciting end to the season.
And you've got Shells next, of course. And when they came back from 2-0 down to 2-0, that could have been a really valuable point for them, but it didn't happen.
No, I didn't see the game, to be honest, but obviously they came back and Pat's won in the end. So yeah, I didn't see it because I can't really comment.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the Applewell game then. I mean, to get to these stages, the league phase, it's such an achievement, but the level of opposition, you'd imagine, will go right up now.
Yeah, it will, but nothing that we haven't faced this year already. Sparta and Pauk, two top teams, so nothing that we haven't faced. We know we're against a good team, but I think that's pretty standard when you're at this stage of the competition.
Yeah, it was previously home and away. You get a chance to look at your opponent and maybe in the second leg. That's no longer the case there. How does that change your thinking or your approach?
Oh, I like the new format. It is good when you get to see a team first and then get to play them again. You get a real feel for them. But I do like the new format and all the competitions. I think it gives everyone a chance and makes every game exciting.
When you look at the group you have, though, and you know, you probably target games like Larne and TNS as ones that you can get points on. What about Applewell at home?
I think any of our home games we got going from them. It's going to be difficult, of course. We're against a good team, we know that. But I think any of your home games, you've got to try target wins, and that'll be the end tomorrow night. We've got to be patient, and we've got to know that we're against a good team, but we've got to try to win the game.
In terms of your principles, in terms of the way you set out, I mean, is anything going to change? European competition in the past has been something where you try and not give away too much at home, but are you going to go for it?
I think there's times in the games you do go for, there's times you got respect that you're going to be without the ball and against a good team, and that's European football, and that's against this level of opposition. So I think there's a whole lot that goes into the mix when you're talking about winning European games at this level.
Game on 2FM.
So that was Stephen Bradley speaking to Tony O'Donoghue. We have a couple of minutes left in the show. Alan Colley is still with us. Alan, are you expecting another famous European night in Tallaght Stadium tomorrow?
Yeah, I think they have a good chance, Shane. And I think when you look at, obviously, the opposition that they're going to face over the coming weeks, I think they have a really good opportunity to do some damage in this competition. TNS coming up, obviously from Wales. Now they'll target Shamrock Rovers as a game that they feel as though they can win as well, and of course the game against Larne in a couple of weeks. So but I said this when the draw was made, I actually think Shamrock Rovers, purely for the fact that I know they're still in the title race, but there's only really two games that'll kind of distract them really throughout the European run, if you like, from the league games that are upcoming. So I think they can really target this European competition and the group stage and really go after it.
Can they turn it around then? And I say this impartially as well, considering it's going to be a tough test on Thursday, to then go out again and Tala on Sunday as well for a crucial league fixture.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the interesting thing for me tomorrow when I see the lineup. I think I think Stephen Bradley and Shamrock Rovers, they have to go after the game tomorrow. A home game in Europe, when you think of the rewards, obviously they've earned a lot of money as it is, but there's plenty of money for just winning a game in each group match as well. So I think they have to go after that, Shane. And he's listing off some players there that he's got back from injury as well. Like, the squad is better than anything in the league. So if there's any club that can cater for playing on a Thursday and again on a big game on Sunday, it has to be Shamrock Rovers. So I think they have plenty of strength and depth to cater for both games. Of course, Shelburne are the ones with a couple of injuries and suspensions as well, that I'll be really curious to see what their lineup is going to be on Sunday. But I think we're at the stage of the season where you have to just go after every game. There's only four games left in the league. Shamrock Rovers obviously have six in this group stage as well. But I think because they're so involved in the competition, they have to go after each game.
Very much so. Alan Colley might even get the game on Sunday. Bring the boots with you. You never know. Injury crisis at the club.
I'm hearing, Shane, yeah.
Gents, we're going to have to leave the conversation there. We've ran out of road. Alan Colley, thank you as always. Great chat. And Eric Hahn, thank you so much for popping in the studio as well. The new music show with January Winters is up next after we check in with the news desk. Marie Crowe will be back tomorrow on Game On, and she will be joined by a hero of the Irish Olympic summer, Charlene Maudsley. From all of the Game On team, it is bye for now. 2FM.